Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, we're broadcasting from the Sandwich Public Library, and Library Director Diane Castagliola is with us. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Indy.
All right, so it's been really interesting visiting these area libraries and seeing how unique each of them are. They all seem to kind of have their own personality. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you think stands out here in Sandwich?
I think that we are very fortunate to be in this wonderful location in historic Sandwich Village. And as a result of that, we just get tons of foot traffic. And we're around area businesses, museums. So I think that it makes us really feel like a vibrant part of the community, which is amazing. We're not a library that's out in the middle of nowhere. So we get lots of great foot traffic. And I think that, you know, 3 years ago now, we went through a $3.5 million renovation. So I think that our interior space is beautiful. We are provide a lot of wonderful services. And I think that, like I said, yeah, our location's awesome. Mm-hmm. Sandwich Town Band is out on our lawn all summer. The artisans are there on Saturdays. Coming up, we're going to have a band here for Porch Fest. So I think that, yeah, our building plays an important role in the community.
Yeah, you're really part of the whole downtown area.
Exactly.
It's interesting, too, to look at, you know, we go from a couple libraries that are really very low tech to libraries that are very high tech. This is a high tech library, right? You've got everything you could want here, right? You can do Zoom. You can be online. You've got your tech bar out there.
Exactly. So, you know, like a lot of libraries, we have Wi-Fi throughout the building. We have mobile printing. We, of course, have public computers for people to use. We circulate mobile hotspots. We definitely have people here throughout the day that are working. We have this little thing called the Nook. It's like a little private, I'll say phone booth, but it's bigger than that, where people will do Zoom calls. So I think that, you know, we also have scanning services, all that stuff. But I do think that people can come here and be pretty productive all day with the services that we're providing.
Yeah, and with so many people working from home now, in the summer you got the guests a little busy. It's like, let me go to the library.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I think that if you're in a rental with in-laws, we are a great place to come if you need to do some work on your laptop for a while.
And I noticed that we can hear the fans a little bit here in this room. And so we should mention we are in the archives room. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a little bit cool in here.
It's chilly in here.
It is a little chilly.
Yeah, it's 68 out in the world. I think we could be close to 10 degrees cooler in here. Yeah.
But that's to keep, you want to keep the moisture out of the room, right? I mean, that's because of what. So tell us what we might be finding here in this archive room.
Oh, gosh. You know, we have an extensive collection here in the town archives. We have postcard collections, photo collections. We have some diaries. We have a wonderful book collection, too, all related to the history of Sandwich, Cape, and Islands. We have wonderful family histories. I'm sort of looking around the room as I'm doing this. So lots of wonderful resources. I think that one of the nice things about Sandwich, too, is it is a community that values its history. Mm-hmm. And I think that the town has done a wonderful job of preserving the archives and making sure that we have the resources necessary to keep Sandwich history not only alive, but for me as a librarian, accessible.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of fun tidbits we pulled out since we are talking about history. In 1891, patrons had to be at least 12 and could take out one book per person, two per household. Not anymore. You can take as many books
unlimited
as you want.
Yeah. Go crazy.
And this is what I found funny. The fines for overdue books then were 2 cents per day, which stayed that way until 2021.
So we became fine free, as many libraries did, in the past few years, which it's just awesome. I mean, part of what I love about public libraries, and truly what I love about public libraries, is you come in, you tell us your name and your address, and we're like, okay, take whatever you want. Just bring it back to us. Mm-hmm. And 99% of the time it works. Sure, occasionally someone doesn't return something, they spill coffee all over it, whatever. But for the most part, it works really well. So I think that removing fines, just to sort of take that barrier away, that, you know, sometimes life happens and you can't mm-hmm. bring your materials back right away. So it's nice to not penalize people that are just trying to access information resources.
Yeah. And also, I can't imagine, you know, keeping track of all of that. And I don't imagine what you collected in late fees paid for that.
Yeah, not, I think for a lot of libraries, yeah, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, like not worth it. Better just to be able to really provide an amazing service to people.
Okay. All right. So many of the area libraries are like community centers. Mm-hmm. I would say so far every library that we have visited with the Point has really is like a community center. I think this morning you got Weight Watchers mm-hmm. coming in. So what are some of the more popular groups that you have utilizing this as a community center?
You know, I think that we have schools coming in all the time to visit. We have some different groups and associations that will book rooms for their meetings. Yeah, Weight Watchers is here every Thursday. I think, too, we just have so many people come in for all of the programming that we have. So across the board, we have story times from babies all the way up to, you know, four-year-olds before they're in school. We've got book clubs for kids and teens, tons of programming at night for adults. And I think that that's just sort of like, yeah, come here. Mm-hmm. We try to offer something for everyone, and we want people in the building.
I would think probably one of the more challenging age groups is teenagers, right? The young kids, story time, and, mm-hmm. and you know, as they start getting interested in books. And then at some point, maybe that preteen into teens, they sort of drift away sometimes. Is that a challenge to kind of keep teenagers engaged in libraries activities?
We're very lucky. Our teen librarian, Melissa, is phenomenal. She had a kickoff event for summer reading here at night. It was a Friday night. We had mini golf in the library. They had some fake tattoo thing. And we had 40 teens, right?
Oh,
so
wow.
That's just sort of amazing. And I think that, you know, we're still small, but Melissa does a great job of offering a regular book club, opportunities for teens to volunteer at events in the library. So it is a struggle. Teens have a lot on their plate right now, too, always.
Yeah.
All of the demands of school,
homework,
college stuff,
homework some
all
of these kids have is just crazy, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think for any of us, anytime we even just see like three teens in the YA section hanging out for a few minutes,
yeah.
It just feels amazing that we provided that space for them.
It's changed so much. I just think back, you know, obviously before the internet and computers, when I was growing up, you wanted to do research, you had to come to the library.
Right.
That was the only place you could go and find, and everything, you'd have the microfilm that you'd have to, pretty mm-hmm. much everything now is pretty much digitized for the most part.
Yeah, and I think the big difference too, it becomes what teachers are requiring of their students. So if students don't need to come here for homework or research purposes, I think it's awesome that we have popular materials that will interest them and programs and even just comfortable seating. Mm-hmm. I mean, it used to be such a dated thing to reference, but that whole idea of like third space and Starbucks and all of that, mm-hmm. right? But like, I think it's great that the public library, it's like, here's a space where you can come. You don't have to buy anything.
Right.
You can just come here. You're welcome to be here. We're happy to have you. And we're here if you need us for any sort of assistance with anything.
Tell us a little bit about the children's library.
Bustling, I think, as most children's libraries are. I have the, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse. My office is across from the children's room. It's bumping in there at times. Yeah. And I definitely have the stray toddler pop into my office from time to time, which is funny. I think for parents, again, it's a great place to go with your kid. If not for a story time, like, yeah, it's a safe space. There's lots of things for them to do. I had put out this interior space survey to patrons, and some of the feedback that we got from parents was that they wanted more things in the children's room. So we've recently have added puzzles, toys, games to the room so that when kids are here getting picture books, there's also other things for them to be engaged with.
Yeah. And I was amazed. And I've discovered this in the Osterville Library, but I guess you have it too, with the kids' books that actually read to the kids so they can follow along.
It's so important for early literacy. So we have a bunch of, we have a bunch of tools like that. We also recently started a subscription to an app called iVox, which, I mean, yeah, it's the same idea where you can go on this app and download a storybook and it sort of like comes alive and it reads to you and it feels different. It's not like watching a movie. It's engaging, but it really is about like following along mm-hmm. with the text as you're learning to read and developing those skills.
Right. All right. So I'm sure you're always looking to raise some money. So talk about the funding. How are you funded? And then it seems like every library has a couple of those annual fundraisers that everybody looks forward to.
Sure. First of all, I feel very lucky in that we do have great support from the town. So that's wonderful. Our friends of the Sandwich Public Library Group do an incredible job fundraising in really any program, or most any program that you attend here at the library, no matter what age group, has been funded by the Friends of the Sandwich Public Library. Their annual appeal is coming up in October. There'll be more information coming from them. You can find information on their website. And then also Friends of the Sandwich Town Archives, that I know that you're going to be talking to John Walker later, and I'm sure he'll talk about too. They do fundraising, and that really goes to, again, help support the archives. So they're going to be selling, or they are selling, Thornton Burgess Christmas cards, which are
they're adorable. Fabulous.
Yeah,
they're
really
so cute.
They're awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a Thornton Burgess birthday t-shirt. They had this very popular boardwalk t-shirt. And then the other thing that we have here in Sandwich is the Weston Memorial Fund, which was started in 1907 by a woman named Sophia Weston, made a donation to the town to establish the fund. And that's something that we use for different things throughout the year. So, for example, I got some feedback from patrons that they were interested in self-checkout options. So we recently implemented 2 self-checkout kiosks. Those were funded by the Weston Memorial Fund. We have this beautiful historic sign outside the building that money from Weston was used to restore that by Dan Farrington of Farrington Wood Carving here in Sandwich. The sign is beautiful. So that's another option for people. And if someone's really interested in making a donation and they want to talk to me about like a specific collection or something they have in mind, like always, I'm readily available. You can come talk to me about it.
We are live at the Sandwich Public Library. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to give us a call, 866-999-4626, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. After the break, we're going to learn a little more and hear about the Thornton Burgess display. Stay with us. And you are listening to The Point. We are live this morning, broadcasting from the Sandwich Public Library. With us is Library Director Diane Costagliola.
It's Costagliola. It's hard. It's 11 letters. There's 2 L's.
I got it right, the first part of the show.
No, it's hard.
And then also with us now is Christy Lawrence. She's author of Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Diane, you've got this display of Thornton Burgess' 150th birthday commemoration. Tell us about it.
First of all, I have to say that I've only been here since last September, and as someone new to the community, I was not aware of Thornton Burgess. So I sort of came in and was like, oh, we have this whole big celebration plan. It's been so fun. Friends of the Sandwich Town Archives, working with our archivist, Deb Rich, who recently retired, pulled together all of this great content that we have up actually behind the tech bar here at the library with some of his illustrations, photos of him, and they've done an incredible exhibit sort of honoring his legacy and work.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about his legacy, Christy. You wrote a whole book about him. Why did you want to write a book about him? What got you interested in that?
Well, one of the first objectives was possibly making some money off of a book. But the more I got into it, Thornton Burgess was a well-known as a children's author, as you well know. But the greater story that I really found was his role as a conservationist, his significance to 20th century conservation, and his use, really, of children's literature to power his message of conservation. So it's an utterly intriguing story. Yeah. And so the research took about 4.5 years because I did get into the fuller story.
Yeah, and he grew up here in Sandwich. Mm-hmm. And so what was his early life like growing up here in the 1870s?
Well, I did want to mention, too, number one, if you don't mind, can I insert?
Yes, absolutely.
The library is awesome, since we're here to be talking about the library. And I think the staff, I would like to absolutely plug Diane and Sandy and Brian in the way they support the literary community. You can come in here and the resources that, that this library offers, it's such a core part. So the segue is that in Thornton Burgess's, this is the other end of his life, you've asked about the beginning of his life, but he made a bequest to the Sandwich Public Library of $5,000. When he died in 1965.
Was so that was a lot. I thought $1,965,000 went a lot farther than it does now.
Yeah. It was a lot, and it was one of the few that he made. So the library was extremely important to him. His growing up in this village, his father died when he was 5 months old. I mean, I'm sorry, when he was 11 months old. And so he and his mother moved. They both mother and father had a lot of family in the town. So they had the support of family, which is a point I make in the book. They were virtually impoverished, but wealthy in the support of family.
Right. And as you know, prolific writer, not only did he write a syndicated newspaper column for almost 48 years, as mentioned, he wrote a number of children's books. The irony, though, for an author that's so beloved and prolific was he started it out as a means to make a living, not as a passion, right?
Right, yeah. Right, absolutely. And the irony, too, is that he was a journalist, and his first children's book in 1910, Old Mother West Wind, which is still in print, which is phenomenal. But that book was a lark. It was kind of, oh, I'll give this a try. You know, Little Brown editor kind of liked his story. So, oh, this is cool. You know, let's explore this. And the next year, he was laid off a job that he had worked at for 15 years, was extremely good at as a journalist. And he had just remarried. His first wife had died very tragically. And so he'd acquired a new wife, two teenagers. He had a son and his mother and himself to support, and he'd been laid off, the sole source of income. So at that point, anything that he could do to make money was significant. And the children's book that he'd come out with the year before was one of the means, so he pursued it.
Yeah. Many of his outdoor observations in nature were used as plots for his stories, and he was gifted at packing ecological facts in there with fiction, right? So key to his popularity among children were his animal characters, right? So he had Jimmy Skunk, Sammy Jay, Bobby Raccoon. Talk about how he used these characters to introduce children to the natural world.
Well, he used them to introduce children in the same way that he was introduced. He was here in Sandwich, exposed to nature. He spent an enormous amount of time outdoors doing many different things, working as well as play. But he observed the birds, he observed the amphibians, he observed the mammals. And when he decided to turn his imagination into writing children's books, he had this resource, this body of knowledge in his imagination to create these characters. And the idea of using them as a means to give a deeper message that was often there about, you know, being kind to your neighbors and that sort of thing. But Burgess not only had observation, a depth of observation to draw on, but he also studied. So one of the keys to his success was the fact that the realism, the accuracy, I mean, of his books. And I remember Betty Anderson, who was a founder of the Manomet Bird Observatory, telling him she loved the Burgess books. And what hooked her was that when she was a girl, she'd be reading them, and she'd go outside and see exactly what she'd just been reading about. So the accuracy of habitat and relationships was true.
Got an example from your book. You write, when Buster Bear comes wandering along a path looking for a winter home, he initiates a discussion with Flathorns the Moose about the advantages and disadvantages of hibernation. Within the book's first 10 pages, young readers learn that bears feed in summer, eat berries, acorns, and do not have a permanent den, and may travel considerable distances, but don't migrate as birds do to different regions. That's a great example, right? So his his the way he told stories really hit a chord with young readers. Mm-hmm. They really responded to him, right? Mm. Yeah, I mean, his writing style, you say this about his writing style. Burgess likened his writing process to the act of unwinding a ball of twine. Mm-hmm. I begin with the title and unwind. There isn't any plot yet that develops for me as I go along, just as it will go for the reader. When I start a story, I haven't any idea at all how it's going to end.
Which is such a mist as a nonfiction writer. I'm thinking, oh my Lord, how did he possibly do that? It's kind of amazing, you know, that he was able to do that. But his creativity was so rich, and he was writing. He terrified himself in the beginning, again, to earn money to support his family. He signed a contract that he would write a newspaper article a day, or 6 days, mm-hmm. 6 days a week.
Wow.
And any writer can tell you, you know, to publish for print, this was about 500, 800 words every day. And he wrote to family, well, you know, I think that's it. I think, you know, I don't think I can come up with any more stories. And he wrote, as you said, for 48 years, and yeah, he wrote 15,000 stories. Yeah. And then converted them into the book. So, right. It was a good system.
And the illustrations, of course, are key, and that's part of the display, mm-hmm. right, Diane? Harrison, is it Katie? Is that how you say the last name?
Katie.
The illustrations really bring it all to life.
Mm. But the characters are adorable.
Yeah.
I mean, they're absolutely adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people wondered if Burgess had anything to do with them, and if he did, it was minimal. Mm-hmm. You know, the artist, the illustrator, they were the ones who really first began putting clothes on the animals, mm-hmm. and hats and waistcoats and, you know, all of that. Burgess really had nothing to do with that. Right. He was a storyteller.
And, you know, we think of Beatrice Potter when we think of Peter the Rabbit, but mm-hmm. Thornton Burgess had a Peter the Rabbit too.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And I love that you brought this up, because I've given a couple talks on this. It's really fun that Potter people will say, well, Burgess was, you know, plagiarizing Peter Rabbit, and the Burgess people say, well, Potter was, you know. But Burgess was always very, very clear. Beatrix Potter wrote the Tale of Peter Rabbit and published it in 1901. And it eventually made its way over here. He read it to his young son, and his boy, named Thornton Waldo Burgess, was very familiar with Peter Rabbit. So mm-hmm. when Burgess began writing his stories, the animal character had to be Peter. It mm-hmm. had to be, you know, Daddy could name any character, any other animal character, anything, but Peter had to be Peter. So he stuck with it, and he tried changing it at one point, and the publisher, the public, and his son would have none of it. None of it.
Not doing that.
But he was clear. He was clear, and the issue was his plagiarism, you know. Mm. It would be raised today. It would be raised seriously today. And so I consulted in writing the biography a couple authorities to see what their take on this was. And the fact is, this was at the dawn of children's literature, and things were different then. And it wasn't the issue that it surely would be today.
Yeah. Well, I don't look at it as plagiarism. I mean, like, it's the character's name. Peter's mm-hmm. a pretty common name. Mm-hmm. The stories are different, you mm-hmm. know? So I don't know. I don't think I would call it plagiarism.
Yeah, yeah.
What did they say? Imitation is the
finest form of flattery.
So, yeah. So he also did a radio program, and he started it out reading his syndicated newspaper column, right? In mm-hmm. 1925, he introduced the Radio Nature League. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is fun, Mindy, because as you and I were saying earlier, you had me on to discuss this mm-hmm. radio program. The Radio Nature League was possibly one of the first nature programs for children on radio. And back in the 1920s, radio was akin to the internet. It was
entertainment, mostly.
It was entertainment, but it was also the source of great information. And Thornton Burgess grasped immediately this was a means of getting nature information to the public, to children and to adults. And he jumped on it in the Radio Nature League. He put out the invitation, oh, would you like to join my Radio Nature League? If so, you know, let me know. He had, oh my gosh, was it 5,000 people signed on within the week? And so it speaks to his popularity. It speaks to the hunger of the public.
Right.
For this kind of information.
Yeah, it, this was, he teamed up with Austin Hobart Clark, a scientist at the Smithsonian, to bring the scientist voice to the airwaves. So this was really a big effort to incorporate education into that, as you say, entertainment radio medium, which you have to remember, radio was pretty much kids. It's like that was where everybody went.
That was it.
Yeah, exactly.
He and Austin Hobart Clark at the Smithsonian shared this vision of using radio for promoting science. So it could look like entertainment, but they had a very serious educational intent.
And they were brilliant in that they would mention the Nature League members by name on the air and let listeners write in questions that they would answer on the air. So he, not only radio happens to be an intimate medium as it is, but he really brought that audience in with him.
Well, there was another level of the intimacy, and that was that the young listeners were encouraged, if they had questions, to send in the corpses of the questionable caterpillar or the moth or whatever it was. So Burgess would be getting these boxes. And one of the stories that he tells was the time someone sent a live snake for identification.
Oh, no.
And it got loose in the WBZ newsroom.
Boy.
Yeah.
He also had one of his characters, Aunt Sally, which was based on a relationship, a friendship he had here with another Sandwich native.
Well, you're talking about Aunt Arabella, his real aunt who lived on Champond. Aunt Sally lived on what's now Route 6A going out to East Sandwich. But both of these women modeled. He met Aunt Sally later in life. Aunt Arabella he knew as a boy, but they both had extraordinary relationships with animals. And so he had demonstrated for him, I think you could say relationship, communication, maybe friendship even, with animals. These two women were really remarkable. I call them, in the book, I refer to them as animal whisperers.
Yeah, right. That's right. Animal. All right, so it's the 150th
birthday,
yes,
celebration,
and
anniversary.
And Thornton Burgess's relatives came to Sandwich, right, for this? Tell us about this.
It was unbelievable. So this is a big year. The library has been absolute dynamite over helping to celebrate it. The library put on the 4th of July float, which won, let it be duly noted, first prize in the Sandwich 4th of July parade. So the Burgess family, the word went out, this is a big year. Let's get together, let's have a reunion, let's come to Sandwich. So they did, the plan was, and they stayed in various places around. And I thought, you know, I live in Thornton Burgess's birthplace, so invite them, have them come over. What an opportunity. How many of us get to see the birthplace of our ancestor who was born in 1874, for example? So I invited them. It was close to 15 Burgesses who came. When I met Thornton Waldo Burgess the V and Thornton Waldo Burgess the VI, I was undone.
Yeah.
I was undone. Honest to truth, it was just such a moment. And Peter Okers, who's also a researcher, Burgess researcher at Salem University, both of us were, our eyes were just, you know, we were stammering with the excitement of meeting these two people.
I would think they would also be excited to meet you and Peter, because you have been like, you probably know more about Thornton Burgess's life than they do.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely true. And that's what they were saying. But it was an historic moment, mm-hmm. you know. And so in my living room, 30 people were seated. Half of them were the Burgess family. And the other half, I had invited people who had contributed to sustaining Burgess's legacy.
Mm.
And I wanted the family to meet them.
Oh,
Nancy
nice.
Titcomb, the founder of the Thornton Burgess Society. Stu Parsons, the first naturalist, the first employee. Jane Schott and his wife, who was one of the directors. One of the directors. Susie Lott. Carol Telligan, who was at Greenbrier Jam Kitchen forever and ever, and her mother ran it. So these were, every person who was there who was not a family member had some role in mm. sustaining the legacy.
Yeah.
And so here are these two groups that had a chance to meet each other and just savor that moment.
And how fun that they carry on the name. Thornton Burgess the fifth and sixth.
I know. So Thornton Burgess the sixth is about 17, just a lovely young man. And his dad, I think mid-50s thereabouts.
Yeah.
And you know what's amazing? What you said is true, because I took one look at him and I said, oh my gosh, you look like Thornton Burgess's son. And he did. I could see the family resemblance. Yeah.
There you go. Christy Palmer Lawrence's book is Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess. We'll have a link with more about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for being with us. It was really fun chatting with you.
Thank you so much,
that.
Mindy.
All right. Coming up after a break, a bit of sandwich history. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're broadcasting from the Sandwich Public Library this morning. With us is the library director, Diane Castagliola. Did I even get it close?
Castagliola, you're good.
Gets better each time. Also joining us, John Walker. He's the vice president of Friends of the Sandwich Town Archives. Hi, John.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
I'm good. So we should mention that your grandfather had a connection to Aunt Sally of Thornton Burgess fame.
Yes, he did. He... provided a lot of, he was a baker, and he provided a lot of day-old bread and was used by Aunt Sally to feed her animals. She had the animal nightclub, she called it, and it was basically raccoons, skunks, possums, and she would feed them by hand, and they would actually come and sit in her lap.
Wow.
That's amazing.
We don't want to do that nowadays.
No.
And while we're talking about Thornton Burgess, before we move on to anything else, we sort of touched, Diane, you touched on the Christmas cards, the mm-hmm. holiday cards coming up. They are so cute. And so tell us about the who was this your idea, John?
It was not my idea. We would give this idea to Deb Rich, who just retired, mm-hmm. our archivist, and she selected the pictures, and they came out wonderful.
Yeah, so if people are interested, just come on down here to the library, right? You can get them right here. Yeah. They're already for sale now?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. They're great. All right, so, John, tell us a little about the mission of the Friends of Sandwich Town Archives.
The Friends of the Archives, we try to provide some financial support for the preservation of documents, photos, manuscripts, some books, some select items. We don't have a lot of room for large bulky items, but we will sometimes accept mm-hmm. them. And we've tried to preserve them. We also want them to be accessible to the public. A lot of this stuff is very important when you're doing research. And we have to have an environment that maintains them. And what we're trying to do is just support the archives. We purchase pieces of equipment and so forth. And one of the more important things that I think that we do is we give out a scholarship every year mm-hmm. to a Sandwich High School senior. It's named after Barbara Gill, who was a longtime archivist here, and so that scholarship goes out every year. We just were able to raise a little extra money this year, and went up from $1,000 to $1,500 scholarship.
Very helpful. And Diane, I would imagine this is a very important mission for the library. And like I said, this room we're in, which is housing a lot of this historic stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it's chilly. but yeah, it has to be. It's chilly. And even you got your the people who've come into the library and seen the clock.
Yes.
Which hasn't worked in a very long time. It's working.
Yes, our grandfather clock is back. It made its way to the library apparently in 1981. It hasn't been working for a while, and the good people at Penn and Pendulum and Mattapoisett recently restored it. It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It looks absolutely incredible. You will hear it from time to time. And I just want to also say, though, for me as the library director, some of the best support that Foster provides is just that support. Mm-hmm. They're a delight to meet with once a month. It's a group of people that are so enthusiastic about sandwich history and preservation and making sure that we keep the history alive and that people can access it. And it's such a nice group to work with.
Yeah. And John, Sandwich, the oldest incorporated town on the Cape. So there's a lot of history here.
Yes, there is. We could go on for hours.
I think one of the things when people hear Sandwich, they may think of glassmaking, right?
Yes.
That's one of the things Sandwich is known for. Yep.
Yes, glassmaking. You talked about my grandfather briefly. My grandmother actually volunteered over at the Glass Museum cleaning the items over there, which was kind of a stressful job because you have to be careful how you were picking up items, and you don't want to drop anything, obviously. But as a young adult in this town, we spent a lot of time down where the old factory used to be, looking for shards of glass, and they would. You know, back then in the 1800s, anything that was broken was just trash, and it was thrown into a pit. And so the marsh was full of broken glass.
So are you telling me Sandwich is the best place to find beach, the sea glass walking along there?
Well, this isn't, this was Sandwich glass, not sea glass.
Okay.
And, everything's been pretty picked out down there, I'm going to say. So don't go running down. You're not going to find much. But, you know, down in that where that road leads out to the boardwalk, there was quite a bit of broken pieces of glass. And people made artwork out of it and still do if, you know, you can find it.
Yeah. And so it pretty much the earlier Sandwich was pretty much more of an agricultural community, right?
There was quite a few farms in Sandwich, and it was a very small town. The numbers of population in this town was in the 1100, 1200, 1500 range. Mm. The glass factory is what expanded the population, and the population jumped up. I don't know the number off the top of my head. And then when the glass factory closed, the population dropped off significantly again. And even when I was a young child here, there was, 4,000 people in the whole town. Very small.
And you mentioned you practically lived in this library when you were growing up.
Yes, I lived right around the corner on Water Street by the pond. And I could actually cut through the woods, which is now the little playground behind the church. There was a pathway. We cut through and come down, and I was in this library all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. I read every book in this library that had to do with dinosaurs. Dinosaurs and the Civil War were my two things.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the reasons we've been wanting to do these programs around at the different libraries is to let people know, like, how many cool libraries there are and how much cool stuff there is, because we all love our local library, but how often do we get out to see others? And I was surprised, John, to learn that you knew a lot about many of the libraries across the Cape.
I love libraries. Yeah. I go when, even when I travel in New England, if I find the town library, I go in and I just want to look and see what's going on. I was in New Jersey last week and went to the library in the town that I was in. And I compare it to this place, and it was similar, but not as good, I would say. Their children's room was incredible. It was pandemonium in that children's room.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're coming back with ideas?
I know
what
you were saying earlier. It was pandemonium in there. And my grandson was part of it, the pandemonium. So, but yeah, so I love libraries. I was saying earlier, Eldridge Library and Mashpee Library. I love Mashpee Library. Plymouth Library. Sturgis is my favorite other than this one. And Osterville, you guys were talking about the Osterville before.
Yes. We're so lucky to have so many great libraries. Diane, do you all as library directors, meet and talk about what you're doing?
Absolutely. Sandwich is part of the Old Colony Library Network, which is libraries mainly on the South Shore. We have regular meetings. We're always visiting each other's libraries, trying to get ideas and collaborating. And since being on the Cape, I will say that all of the library directors in the CLAMS Network, which is the Cape and Islands, have been so welcoming to me and sort of keeping me up to date too and what they're up to all the time.
Yeah, so what's the biggest challenge for library directors now? Is it keeping up with all the technology or no?
I think we always talk about remaining relevant. Yeah. And I think that is just making sure that you're always thinking about what your community needs specifically. And that maybe if there's a trend that works for one library, it's not going to work for you. And I think we do always sort of, I think, have to be out there reminding people we're here, we have all these services. And I think a lot of times people come into the library for the first time in a long time, whether it's because they're coming with their grandkids or for some reason, they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that the library offered so many wonderful services.
Yeah. John, your grandparents ran a gift shop and restaurant downtown from the late 1940s to the mid 1960s. What do you remember about it?
Not much. I was born in 60, so but I have.
You've heard stories.
Yeah, I've heard stories, and I found a photo of myself as an infant, in there with Ed Zion, who was the life. I mean, he was the head women's basketball coach for the high school forever, and a math teacher, and my mother was one of the best basketball players this town ever produced.
Oh,
and
wow.
So he was down there visiting, and they have a picture of me with Ed Zion and in the front room there. And the other thing that I recall was we live over here. We would head down to visit, and my grandfather would have stopped here in his car, and my father would pile us in to their station wagon, and we would drive down there. And we would, and I think they did it on purpose, but we would cut through behind where McDonald's Hardware is and cut over to 6A that way, not to go to the traffic light. And my grandfather would go by the traffic light, and we would always beat him. And, now that I think about it, I'm like, that was planned that way, I think, because we would be, back in the 60s, we're standing in the back seat, pounding, going, go, beat him.
Yeah.
And, I don't have many recollections of in there inside at all.
I bet you hear a lot from people who did, though.
Yes, yeah. I do. A lot of people worked for him, and, he had the restaurant, the snack bar, and he was always doing crafts and making things. And they, after he actually became Keith Pharmacy, then Thayer Pharmacy, and now it was like a home care network was the most recent thing that was in that building. And he opened his own little gift shop in his house down on 6A. He actually was the executor of Aunt Sally's estate, and as a result, he ended up building a house right next to where Aunt Sally's house was, or still is, what's left of it. And so he had his gift shop out front, and he had a little, it was a barn attached to the main house, and my grandmother painted, my grandfather built stuff out of driftwood and wood.
Right. So. Now, there's many landmarks here in town, including the Shaker Round Barn, which has all those great historic cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What are some of the other ones that you can think of?
Growing up, at the Hoxie House, the Glass Museum, the grist mill. And, you know, at the school, everybody went to the wing school back then, which unfortunately is gone, but most of it. They kept the old 1927 building, the original. But the, you would walk on your field trips, and every year there would be a field trip to the Hoxie House, then the grist mill, the glass museum. Mm-hmm. And so those are the places that I, remember.
Yeah. That field trip still happens.
I was just going to ask you.
And then we wind up, we get some tuckered kids here at some point. We're part of the tour. They're on foot doing their whole little thing. Yeah.
And many of the libraries have passes to museums and things.
Yes.
And I would imagine that the Glass Museum is a highlight for folks. Do they come in?
Oh, my gosh,
and go,
yes.
Can I get to the
Absolutely.
Passes?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, correct. Like most libraries, we have, I think we have over 30 museum passes funded by the Friends. But I think we're one of the few with the Sandwich Glass Museum on their list.
Yeah. So do you ever have like a waiting list for those or no?
There can be. They can get booked pretty quickly, but I think for the most part we have multiple passes to the more popular sites, mm-hmm. and usually people can get exactly what they want.
All right. So John, you mentioned that Sturgis was your favorite after this, because mm-hmm. of course Sandwich is your favorite library.
Yeah, my whole library, yeah.
So tell me what it is about this library that you love so much.
This one here?
Yep.
I don't know. You spend your whole childhood in a building, and I just had such fond memories of the place, and I can't say anything else other than that. And I love to read, and I learned that here. Oh. And reading is a big part of my life still, and this was the birthplace of that.
Right. And Diane, you've only been here for what, a year? A little over a year?
Yeah, a year. Coming up in mid-September.
And you have worked at some other libraries before that. So how does this experience compare? You mentioned the support that you're feeling from the town. And
yes, I feel very lucky. We have, like I said, wonderful support from the town, delightful patrons. Other library directors will say, oh, I'm dealing with something with my friends of the library. Oh, I'm dealing with my trustees. And I'm always like, I have 9 wonderful trustees. Wonderful support from the Friends of the Sandwich Town Archives. Wonderful support from the Friends of the Sandwich Public Library. So I feel very lucky to be here.
And kind of breathing a big sigh of relief that summer's coming to an end, because you had like something like 80, like you had like a million programs going.
Again, like most public libraries, summer reading happens, and we had 80 programs for all ages. We had just under 200 adults participating in summer reading. We had over 350 kids participating in summer reading. We had close to 50 teens participating in summer reading. So it's been a very active summer. Add that to the fact that, out here during the summer, it's busy on the street.
Right.
You get tourists, people coming in. So we've seen a lot more foot traffic.
All right. Anything coming up that you want to mention before we say goodbye?
Yes. We have a great partnership with Titcoms. So Tuesday, October 8th, Chris Whitaker, New York Times bestseller, will be here. So you can check out the Titcoms website for more information. We have a concert coming up in October. Matt York singing Willie Nelson. Like I think I mentioned this, we'll be involved with Porch Fest. We'll have a band out on the lawn. But yeah, lots of, as always, exciting things coming up. We're working on developing a new collection of the hottest books that are out right now. Ooh. No Holds, Lucky Day collection. You come in the library, you happen to be able to get it. And September is library card sign up month.
Right.
So if you don't have a library card,
come
see
on
us.
In. Yeah.
Yes.
And you can use that in any Clams library. Right?
Oh, no, we're OCLN.
Oh, okay.
So we're Old Colony, yes.
Old Colony. Okay, got it. And we'll put a link with more information for the library at our website, capeandislands.org. John Walker, Vice President of the Friends of Sandwich Town Archives, and the Library Director, Diane Castagliola.
Thank you.
Thanks for hosting us today.
Thank you so much for coming here.
Yep, thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.